it's time for the middle of the week, ladies and gentlemen. One of the advantages of starting the work week after a three-day weekend on Tuesday. Welcome to the radio program of record. This fourth day of September, the John Carlson Show, coming to you live every day of the work week, unless it's a holiday or vacation. And we have been for the better part of, are you ready for this, 30 years. How about that? Where were you in the mid-90s? It is 3.5 minutes after 6 o'clock. Of course, we love your feedback. We love hearing from you. Go ahead and give us a shout at 206-421-5757. Doesn't matter if you are texting or calling. Either way is fine. All right, we have got so much stuff that we want to get into, local and national. And, of course, we certainly welcome your feedback. Murmurings about a poll showing Dave Reichert rapidly gaining ground on Bob Ferguson. And a poll hasn't been officially released yet, but it shows the gap. Remember the primary, the difference between Ferguson and Reichert in the primary was, I believe, 17, 18 percentage points.
Based on the vote, right?
Based on the primary vote. Now, there were 24 names on the ballot.
Good point. Good reminder. So many contestants in that one.
And the information I have been given says that he has closed that gap to within single digits. This is very interesting. It just shows a steady progression of where people are going and thinking. Remember, Ferguson tried to end this race in the primary, spent millions of dollars, $3 million. In the primary, Bob Ferguson did on TV ads alone.
Yeah, way outspent.
Spent about
right?
$7 million overall. I mean, just huge and big push on voter turnout, the whole bit. I have to hand it to them. They ran a very commendable campaign trying to make him look like he's the law enforcement candidate, the guy who wanted to end all criminal penalties for fentanyl use, for crystal meth use, for heroin injection. He was portraying himself as the public safety candidate, which is pretty audacious if you can get away with it. Well, because he saturated the airwaves and Reichert just didn't have as much money, his message got through and he ended up with, you know, he naturally wanted to get 50% of the vote and say, okay, this race is over. But instead, he ended in the mid-40s. Reichert was in the high 20s. And people said, well, that's still a pretty big gap. But now that those people have, you know, who are backing other candidates are looking at the final two, and that a lot of voters who did not vote in the primary are taking a second look. If you look at the county-by-county rundowns, a lot of the more Republican-inclined counties had low voter turnout. So this is, we might have ourselves a race here. This is very interesting. We have more than a hope and a prayer when it comes to the governor's race. So that's a good way to start a Wednesday. Here's another great way to start your Wednesday. As you know, we have the almost world-famous legendary lyric contest that we invented right here on Talk Radio 570 KVI. How long have we been doing this, radio legend Mark Christopher?
I know, I can't see my notes, John. It's too foggy.
Yeah, there's that.
Almost 2 years now, maybe, just on the whim when you said, since we're playing these songs, why don't we make it fun? And not only have people call in requests here for these bumpers of all these great songs of the 60s, 70s, 80s, and more, but maybe we could do a contest.
So
and
here is the contest.
Yeah.
We give you lyric to a classic American hit, a song that, as defined by, oh, everyone would know that song if they heard it.
Yeah.
That's our criteria.
From the American charts, probably.
Like an earworm status. You hear it, you're going to be singing this song all day.
Yeah. Oh, I know that group. Yeah, I remember that song. Or, oh, my parents love that song. Anyway, here, the way it works is I read you the lyric, and then we will play it sometime in the next two and a half hours.
The actual
could be
song
very soon. Could
with
be
the lyric itself, yes.
The original. And when you hear it, be the 10th caller and identify either the song or the artist. Most people usually call with both. And you got some nice prizes coming your way. Isn't that right, Mark?
Always fun. Daniel's Broiler right up top. They've been with us since the beginning here because they want you to try their USDA prime steak and other specialties, the chicken, the fresh seafood. Boy, what a hit for summertime with everybody coming to town. You want to impress cuisine of the Northwest. And you want to remind yourself, get to danielsbroiler.com, reserve a table, make your online reservation. Four locations, Bellevue, downtown Seattle, Leschi, South Lake Union. Thank you, Daniel's Broiler. All right, we've done the Doobie Brothers for concert tickets. They're at the White River Amphitheater this Friday. We just did the Happy Together tour.
Right, right.
At the Washington State Fair. I think I found some more, John. All right, everybody, who remembers these bands?
Give me all your loving, all your hugs and kisses, girl.
The legendary ZZ Top.
Oh, yeah, man.
And how about these guys? So here's what we have. Two tickets.
One of, I think, the greatest rock anthems of all time. Is that fair? One of the greatest? Freebird?
I suppose so.
How many movies do you think of in TV shows when you hear Freebird? Mm. All right. So it's two tickets for ZZ Top and Lynyrd Skynyrd with the Outlaws, which Lynyrd Skynyrd, 50th anniversary last year, Jacksonville, Florida, 1973. Gosh, it's been that long. Hundreds of millions of albums, Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Keith Richards had the honor to put them there. And, of course, ZZ Top, they've been around with all the videos here. It's part of the sharp-dressed Simple Man tour that they came up with last year or so. Saturday, September 21st, White River Amphitheater. Again, ZZ Top, and then Lynyrd Skynyrd with the Outlaws. Two tickets with Daniel's Broiler.
That sounds like a great prize pack. Here's your lyric. I want to give it the right cadence. I don't want to give you a misleading cadence. Take me back, way back home. Not by myself, not alone. Where have you heard that lyric before? Take me back, way back home. Not by myself, not alone. There you go. That is your legendary lyric for this morning's program. All right? Okay. We got a lot of other great stuff we want to get into here on the Commute with Carlson. I'm updating a story that we first brought you in late March of 2023. It was terrible. A school shooting in Nashville, Tennessee. A private Christian school, very popular and acclaimed a Christian school called the Covenant School. A mass shooter killed 6 people, including 3 children. There was speculation about why it all happened, but authorities never assigned a motive. Then it turns out the shooter left a journal, a 90-page journal, which law enforcement refused to release. No particular reason except, while this is under investigation, I'm afraid we can't release this. A lot of controversy back and forth that, you know, the case that the shooter is dead. The case, everything has seemingly been answered except the obvious question of motive. So the journal tells us the motive, but authorities are very tight-lipped, refuse to release it. Well, now it has been released. The Tennessee Star published all 90 pages of it. The shooter, Audrey Hale, who had been a student at the school, revealed her motive. She hates Christianity, and she hates white people, even though she is white herself. She also is transgender. And so what you have here is someone who did not feel comfortable being a teenage girl, insists that she was a male because she was in love with another female who apparently passed away. And so she decided to make a statement against the targets of her hatred. Christian children and people who work at the school she used to attend. She entered the school randomly, shooting at children or adults. She didn't care. It happened on March 27th, 2023. On March 13th, she wrote in her journal, "Two more weeks. Thank F-word. I plan to die. Plan in mind, and a plan to near perfection." She expressed hope that her massacre would make the Columbine killers proud of her. She mentioned the school in February, said Covenant was closed yesterday. I guess it was because of the weather. Audrey went by the name Aiden and yearned for an interracial relationship with someone identified as Sydney and another girl identified as Paige. She addressed Paige in the journal saying, "I'm going to kill people someday. Please don't be mad. I'm going to do something sometime. It's too sad to even think you might feel. I'm so sorry. I love you." On January 9th, a couple of months before the shooting at Covenant School, Audrey Hale, going by the name Aiden again, said, "Sydney is gone, but my father is still alive. It should be the other way around." She attacked and criticized her parents and the Christian religion throughout the notebook. She was disgusted that they think religion can change nature. Well, that's kind of the point. And she blamed her mother's conservative upbringing for not accepting her contention that she's really a boy and not a girl. The day of the shooting, she wrote in the journal, "Can't believe I'm doing this, but I'm ready. I hope my victims aren't." And she wrote, "My only fear is if anything goes wrong, I'll do my best to prevent of the sort. God, let my wrath take over my anxiety." She's asking God's help to carry out mass murder. She She said, it might be 10 minutes. It might be 3 to 7. It's going to be quick. I hope I have a high death count. Ready to die, ha ha. Signed, Aiden. Again, the name Audrey was going by. Her last words were, remember me for the good things. Well, I don't think so. Anyway, it was a anti-Christian, anti-white hate crime shooting. Do you think if this had been someone who was targeting, I don't know, gay students, that law enforcement would have tried to keep people from seeing this? Tennessee authorities. I don't know if it was law enforcement acting on their own or law enforcement doing what their political overseers in Nashville were ordering them. I don't know the political chemistry of Nashville politics. Or do you think that they simply, well, it's not the narrative that would have been preferred, so forget it. If they had targeted people of color, if they had targeted gay students, you really think it would have taken a year and a half to see this journal? A year and a half. So now, finally, we know the truth, and like anything that does not serve the narrative of the political progressives, they tried their darndest to keep people from knowing what that truth was. I don't know if you're going to hear it anywhere else, but you do hear it on the John Carlson Show. That's what makes the show indispensable. Along with, of course, the fact that we have the great social media sweep of Philip J. Vandiver III coming around the corner and our legendary lyric contest, which is now underway if you missed it. It's a hit from the 70s, and the lyric is, take me back, way back home, not by myself, not alone. When you hear it, be the 10th caller. All right, Philip J. Vandiver III, what's going on in the social media world?
Well, Seattle's had a lot of wild crime stories, but they had one yesterday morning that involved the smash and grab of an ATM using a front-end loader. And it happened in the what you'd think would be the relatively quiet area of North Queen Anne, the social media sweep, sponsored by Muckleshoot Casino Resort.
And those are not easy to come by.
A front-end loader.
There's a lot of trucks and machinery you can rent, but front-end loaders here in King County, at least within the Seattle area.
So North Queen Anne, SPU area?
Exactly. This was an ATM machine that was outside the SPU, Seattle Pacific University bookstore. There on, is that Nickerson that runs out that direction?
Uh-huh. Nickerson parallels and 3rd Avenue West.
It parallels the Ship Canal.
That's my old name.
That goes from Lake Union out to Ballard, the Ballard Locks, and then out to Shilshole Bay. So that's the area of North Queen Anne that we're talking about. And the suspects are still on the loose. King 5 did some, every TV station in Seattle has reported on it. And King 5 talked to a young man who looks like he's a pretty much college age near the campus. And when he'd found out about what happened with this front-end loader, he compared it to that video game, popular video game, Grand Theft Auto, where you basically get to roam through a landscape of Los Angeles, California, and drive cars, fly helicopters, and basically commit lawlessness.
Don't remember heavy lifting machinery being part of that.
When you get
some enterprising coder must have included it in one video game or another. So you're going to hear his comments about how this is like Grand Theft Auto, and then you're going to hear the explanation of this front-end loader used to try and steal this ATM.
That's just like GTA stuff. Like, you don't think that stuff happens every day.
Seattle police confirmed to King 5 that two suspects stole a front loader from the construction site on 15th Avenue Northwest and Market Street.
It's not just like stealing a candy bar. Like, you're stealing a whole machine over there. Like, that's crazy.
They then drove it from 15th and Market all the way across the Ballard Bridge.
But they didn't stop there. That's when they headed towards the SPU campus.
And they then drove east towards Seattle Pacific University's bookstore parking lot. This video shows the front loader ripping out the ATM from the wall SPD says as officers tried to stop them, one suspect jumped from the front loader into the bed of an accomplice's truck, and they got away. The front loader then rolled into the back of a patrol car, causing damage but no injuries.
So when the thief bailed out of the front end loader, didn't put on any sort of a brake or didn't get it stopped, and that's when it rolled in the patrol car. So you've got two suspects still at large. They were trying to get this ATM scooped up into the bucket of the front end loader and failed. They basically kept pushing it down the street in their attempt to do so.
Oh, man. What a couple of losers.
Yeah.
What a couple of losers.
The fact that they didn't crash this front end loader into anything else or damage traffic lights or intersections or anything like that, because it's a pretty tricky maneuver to get underneath, because you're going southbound on the Ballard Bridge, and then you got to cut back against Elliott Avenue, 15th Avenue, get back over to the North Queen Anne side. It's a miracle that they didn't destroy anything else.
Think about what
they did.
When you go to get your pickup loaded with gravel or beauty bark, that's the kind of tractor they scoop up. These guys had to come across the Ballard Bridge southbound. At the end of the bridge, you make a right.
Mm-hmm.
You hit that little stop sign. You then make a left. That's
and then
very
you have
tight.
To do a 270.
Go up over that overpass and come back down, and nobody suspected this is not normal.
That's it all happened in the middle of the night yesterday.
Right
around sunrise yesterday is when all this was being revealed. But
that was quite a run.
ATM thieves and front end loader thieves still on the loose in Seattle.
Okay. Is anyone surprised by anything they hear about coming out of Seattle anymore?
We just keep adding to the book another new experience here in this city and time of life.
All right. At the top of the hour, we're going to be talking about this chilling story. Six people shot on I-5, apparently randomly. One man is under arrest. You had, six vehicles were shot at. Two people were wounded, and bullets narrowly missing children. I mean, just awful. Song again, it's Legendary Lyric Day here on Wednesday. Great prize pack today. You've got your $50 gift card to Daniel's Broiler Restaurants. You also get a pair of tickets to, man, what a duo, Leonard Skinner and ZZ Top. And when's that concert again, Mark Christopher?
That's going to be Saturday, September 21st.
White River?
White River Amphitheater. Boy, are they getting a lot of attention in concerts this year. Doobie Brothers Friday night.
All right. Here is your lyric. It's from a classic hit from the 70s. Take me back, way back home, not by myself, not alone. Take me back, way back home, not by myself, not alone. Where have you heard that lyric before? We will play it. Going in or out of commercial break. And when we do, again, just be the 10th caller, and those prizes come your direction. All right. Interesting story just out. In Midtown Manhattan, okay, the center of downtown New York City, 3 out of every 4 people arrested for crimes such as domestic violence, robbery, and assault are believed to be in the country illegally. 3 out of 4 in New York, which I don't recall being close to the southern border. The New York Post reporting that city police officers are working at a disadvantage when they arrest suspected illegal immigrants because New York City's sanctuary city laws do not permit cooperation with immigration and customs enforcement. Police sources in the Queens borough of New York estimate that more than 6 in 10 of those arrested there are suspected illegal immigrants. So it's not just a downtown problem happening throughout New York City. Quote, New York City eliminated a tool to get rid of violent criminals. What a mess, close quote, says former Queens District Attorney Prosecutor Jim Quinn. The sanctuary city law is pathetic. It's crazy. Last week, the mayor of New York defended the city taking in tens of thousands of illegal immigrants. Well, why wouldn't they want to stay? You're a sanctuary for them. They're just, the illegals are just following the incentives that are in front of them. It's tempting to want to blame the illegal immigrant. But the illegal immigrants are only doing what they're allowed to do, sometimes being told and encouraged to do. So this is why they feel at home in a sanctuary city. The mayor said that it's up to the city council to change the sanctuary city laws. He added that he does believe that illegals who commit violent acts should be deported after serving time behind bars. Well, my goodness, what a conservative position for you to take. If you're here in the country illegally and you assault or rape or kill someone, after you serve your sentence, you probably should be deported. Why don't we take care of that problem before the crimes become violent? The standard that I use, I think, is very fair. The Carlson standard is, what would happen if you entered another country illegally and started committing crime? Do you think they'd say, oh, that's okay, you can stay? For example, do you think that you could enter another country illegally and get a driver's license? It is just madness that you can get one in several states, including this one. In fact, you've heard that you won't be able to use your driver's license. Is it next year? You won't be able to use your driver's license as a form of ID at the airport?
Come May or so, yeah.
Because the only reason they will not allow a Washington State driver's license at the TSA starting sometime in 2025, they won't allow a driver's license to be used for ID is because Washington State stubbornly insists on allowing illegal aliens to get driver's licenses. So if you want a driver's license, it will not serve as ID. You have to get a passport. And if you do want a driver's license to be your form of ID so you can get on an airplane, you will have to buy an enhanced driver's license. In other words, you'll have to pay a surcharge. You'll have to pay an extra fee over and above on top to get a driver's license that you can use as formal ID. The only reason you have to pay that surcharge and get an enhanced license is because Washington allows illegals to get a driver's license. If you shoplift in a foreign country while living there illegally, are they going to let you stay? If you drive drunk and you're in another country illegally, will they let you stay? Again, this is just madness. And yet our government allows it. Our city government allows it. Our county government allows it, in fact, practically encourages it. Our state government allows it. If you are in this country illegally and you break the law, you should pay whatever penalty, whatever consequence there is. And after you have served your sentence, out you go. Is that unreasonable? Is that unfair? If it is, someone please tell me why. See, most people are very reasonable, and most people, if this were on the ballot, would say, well, if you commit a crime, you should be deported. So I'll tell you, you know, we've got these four initiatives on the ballot in November. I think we need, come 2025, I think we'll need another initiative. The initiative would stipulate that anyone charged with a gross misdemeanor or felony in Washington state who is in this country illegally, who is found guilty, will be deported. Local governments will be required to cooperate with immigration and customs enforcement. Let me underscore that. Local governments would be required to cooperate with immigration customs enforcement in deporting these people, getting them out of here. That is how you start getting rid of the problem. Start with the people who make trouble when they're here living illegally. It is coming up here on 47 minutes after 6 o'clock in the morning. You are listening to the John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI. Our good buddy Lars Larson right around the corner. Todd Myers gets some national news attention for the work he has done in battling those who want to tear down the Snake River dams. This is an issue right now that Democrats are being very quiet about because there's an election in 2 months' time. And they would really prefer that not be an issue in the campaign. But once the campaign is over, the ongoing momentum to try and, quote, breach, i.e. tear down, the Snake River dams will continue. Todd Myers and John Stossel talk about that. That's coming your way as well. It's a busy morning on the commute with Carlson. Talk Radio 570 KVI. Hey, the legendary lyric won't reveal the artist. That might give away the song. But when you hear this lyric going in or out of commercial break, just be caller number 10. And here we go. Take me back, way back home, not by myself, not alone. Take me back, way back home, not by myself, not alone. There's your legendary lyric. Here's your legendary noon to three radio host, my buddy Lars Larson.
Thank you.
7 minutes to 7 o'clock. How are you today?
I'm doing very well. And I guess right now we're trying to figure out who's on first, because who is the husband of Linda's son, who's the Chi-Com spy, who worked not just with Governor Kathy Hochul of New York, but former governor and disgraced former governor Andrew Cuomo and members of the state legislature. And isn't that wonderful? And apparently she and her husband made millions. The Chi-Coms, according to the indictment, thought that her influence on the state governor and legislature were worth millions of dollars, which she and her husband quickly spent. I think they planned to enjoy the money because they probably thought they were going to get caught. They bought a nice nice houses.
Yes, they did. Now, let me back up a couple of things. First of all, we are referring to not some bureaucrat laboring in the bowels of New York City or New York State government in Albany. No, no, no. This is Governor Hochul's former top aide.
Deputy Chief of Staff.
Linda's son.
And you'd say, well, what could they influence? Why would China care about the state of New York? Well, number one, state of New York, most populous state, 40 million people, financial center of the world, to some extent, entertainment center of the United States and financial and other. And what did Linda Sun do? In particular, and here I'll show my pro-Taiwan bias, the free China, she would steer folks away to say, we don't want to have contact with Taiwan. We only want to talk to the commies. Which, if you've got to have contact with one China or the other, I recommend the free China, Taiwan.
Well,
the Republic
let me
of China.
Just give you one example. In a speech for the governor, a speechwriter was referring to the Lunar New Year and wanted to include a reference to the Uyghur concentration camps in China, which this aide, Linda Sun, immediately struck from the speech. So there's just one example of who she was really looking out for. Anyway, yes, she has been charged for acting as a Chinese agent. Welcome back. It's the John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI. Good morning. This Wednesday, you know, you get halfway through the afternoon after lunch, you can say, the work week's already half over. It's that's the positive side of an abbreviated work week, courtesy of Labor Day. And we have a lot of things in front of us that we want to get to here on the commute, local and national. This story coming out about the multiple shootings on I-5 is absolutely horrifying. These are people who are basically targeted for death because they are driving their car on a freeway. Anyway, it happened Monday night and early Tuesday morning. They have one man under arrest in Pierce County. This happened primarily, though, in King County on I-5. The state patrol says the shootings were completely random. No road rage here. Just terror. Of those who were hit and wounded, one remains in serious condition. Lin-Ann Nguyen from Como 4 explains the shootings and the arrest of the gunman. Again, they think this is the only person involved so far.
Troopers had to use tourniquets on two victims to try and save their lives. Victims ID'd the suspect vehicle as a white Volvo, and one person on the road was able to provide a license plate, with officers from multiple agencies in Pierce County catching the suspect in the area of University Place.
Lay all the way down on the ground. Hands up. Put your hands behind your head.
Even more concerning, investigators say these shootings seem to be just random.
There's absolutely no reason to suggest these were anything but innocent people drive down the road trying to get from point A to point B, and for whatever reason became the victims of this unwarranted, unprovoked attack.
And the suspect is being held in the King County Jail. We are told more charges could be added on as more victims come forward.
That's what they have discovered, that more people stepped forward. More people have come forward saying, hey, you know, someone was shooting me. My car was hit. I wasn't sure what it was. I think it was part of this. So this story is making national news this morning, as you would think it would. The suspect driving a car with out-of-state plates, California plates. We don't know yet if he, what his prior criminal record, if any, may happen to be. We expect to get that information later today. But I look at this case and I remember a somewhat similar case to it. Now, these are basically someone driving by on the road shooting into cars. Doesn't matter if the person is alone. Doesn't matter if there are little kids in the car. He's just randomly attacking people as he is driving. There was a notorious crime back in 1973 that absolutely froze the attention of people in the Seattle area back in the 1970s. It became known as the Bellevue Sniper case. And what happened was in May of 1973, there were cars driving down Interstate 405 as it passed through Bellevue that were randomly fired upon by someone in the woods nearby the freeway. One person was wounded. Another person, a real estate agent named Abraham Saltzman, was killed. And this was all over the news. This was the news back then, more than 50 years ago. And they eventually arrested a young man named Carl Harp, who was convicted and sentenced to life in prison. Ironically, his parole date would have come up last year. So Carl Harp would have been eligible for parole half a century after the shootings, murder and assault, had he not killed himself. And his fiance continued for years afterwards to say she does not believe he killed himself. She believed he was killed in prison, but he slashed his wrists and hung himself with a TV cable cord in his one-man cell. But I remember what is interesting, the parallel between this case and the Bellevue sniper case, besides the fact that, thank God, no one was killed. We hope that the person who's in Harborview will be better soon. But what is different about this case is, well, it's being treated as a really unfortunate incident. But no, it has not riveted the attention of the community the way that the Bellevue sniper case did. And I, you know, just wonder, my takeaway on this, having lived here in the 70s and continuing to raise my own family, ironically, in Bellevue, is I wonder if we have grown too accustomed to outrageous violence. I wonder if we've become acclimated. I wonder if we're finding, if not something that we approve of, at least, you know, something that we've just become used to. Because in a civilized society, a civilized society doesn't get used to things like this. A civilized society doesn't shrug its shoulders and move on. And I think we've been doing that for way too long with way too many provocations. You know, a 8-month pregnant businesswoman who owned a Korean restaurant in downtown Seattle, Belltown neighborhood, is waiting for the light to change. And somebody walks up to her car. Her husband was in the passenger seat and just empties his pistol at them for no reason. Didn't know them. And people thought, my goodness, that's just a terrible story. And there was a great deal of mourning for the woman in the Korean community, and the restaurant closed. And it was just a very sad, sad story. But then things just moved on. And here we have Ruth Dalton, the 80-year-old lady who was carjacked, run over with her own car just a couple of weeks ago. And, that was just terrible. That's really, really unfortunate. And now people are just kind of moving on. And you say to yourself, what on earth does it take to ignite community outrage, sustained outrage, that results in change? Sustained outrage. What does it take? And look at some of the awful, terrible juvenile crimes that have been committed. Violent carjackings, random carjackings by 13 and 14-year-olds with ghost guns, for crying out loud. And they still haven't changed the way they prosecute juvenile crime. Last week, we said, hey, they're not going to close the juvenile jail. What a victory. Why is that yes, it's good that they're not going to close the jail, but how's that a victory? We are still adopting this incredibly lenient attitude toward violent or violently inclined juveniles who don't care what you say, who don't care what's on paper. They only care about what happens to them. And if nothing bad happens to them when they break the law, you know what? They keep breaking the law, and they'll even ratchet things up a bit. And that has been the sum total of the so-called diversion program. So you got to wonder, what kind of incident does it take to create such anger that it changes policy? It changes the way things are done. Because I don't see it happening. Horrendous crimes committed by mentally ill people, often addled by drugs. And yet, it has been a complete non-starter that they are not going to make it easier to commit seriously mentally ill people with violent tendencies. They are not going to make it easier to commit them to mental health incarceration. They're not going to take them off the streets. They talk about, oh, we need more counseling. Well, what if they walk out after the counseling? Yeah, we hope we can get them back. What about just involuntary commitment for people who are seriously mentally ill? How many more wild, crazy, terrible, awful, ghastly incidents do we need to have happen before we entertain that idea? They want to spend money. They don't want to change That standard, is a lot of the reason why the standard, meaning it makes it very difficult, nearly impossible, to involuntarily commit a mentally ill person, even when they are committing the kinds of crimes that you read about. It is 17 and a half minutes after 7 o'clock. You know it's Wednesday, and Wednesday means it's our legendary lyric contest day. You know how this works. I'm going to read you the lyric to a classic song, and when we do play this song, and we're going to play it within the next 90 minutes or so, just be the 10th caller, and man, do we have some great prizes coming your way.
Yeah, if you didn't catch it last hour, we got Daniels, of course, longtime favorite fan of this as a giveaway partner here with the Daniels Brother gift card. $50 value, your choice. Use it at Bellevue, downtown Seattle, Leschi, South Lake Union. Look at their menu. Advance reservations, you can do that now online. Go to danielsbroiler.com. We have more concert tickets, John and Phil.
I know that band.
Yeah, in fact, it was announced they were going to put together some kind of a little tour last year here, and they didn't want to do it alone, so they asked some friends to join them.
Oh, my goodness.
So here's what we have. Two tickets for ZZ Top and Lynyrd Skynyrd with the Outlaws. This will be coming to the White River Amphitheater. Boy, what a venue. Thank you for your generosity there, White River Amphitheater. Concert, two tickets for yours. This will be Saturday, September 21st. So after the busy times here
first
of
day,
September.
Isn't that the first day of autumn?
First day of autumn. What a way
first
to kick it
second
in.
Second day of autumn. All right.
Yeah, ZZ Top, Lynyrd Skynyrd, and add that to Daniel's Brother, a $50 gift card. What a prize for the win for knowing today's lyric.
Here is your lyric. When you hear it, be the 10th caller at 206-421-5757. That's 206-421-5757. The lyric, take me back, way back home. Not by myself, not alone. One more time. Take me back, way back home. Not by myself, not alone. When you hear it, be caller number 10. And our legendary lyric, that's Brandy from Looking Glass.
As one-hit wonders go, pretty solid.
You know, for a one-hit, that's the kind of song that said, why didn't they have more hits? Mm-hmm. That was a great
song.
Had
a great sound.
Just they had the magic for one song. It's like, okay. Mm-hmm. And they love playing it still.
We'll never know.
Your legendary lyric, which came from a band that was not a one-hit wonder. That's your only hint. From the 1970s. Take me back, way back home. Not by myself, not alone. When you hear it, give us a call, 206-421-5757. Identify that song or the artist, and some great prizes we just talked about are coming your way. All right, Philip J., what's going on in the social media world?
I have an update on this recount in the race for Washington Public Lands Commissioner from the August primary, the media sweep, sponsored by Muckleshoot Casino Resort. The recount managed to find, I think, two extra votes for the Democrat, who will now emerge as a second-place finisher in the primary and advance to the general election in November. Dave Up the Groove is second place to Jamie Herrera Butler. And then the third-place finisher, Sue Keel Peterson, lost by 53 votes. When they started the recount, Peterson was trailing by 51 votes. So somewhere along the line, Dave Up the Groove, the Democrat, managed to attain two more votes.
Wow, that's tight.
Well, out of about 2 million votes cast.
Is the recount concluded?
It's confirmed, yeah.
So yesterday. Yes.
After Secretary of State's office certified the recount yesterday. So I think you had pointed out on prior shows a third recount could be done if Peterson's camp wants to pay for it.
She will have to pay for it, mm-hmm. Yes.
And I have not seen any indication if there's an interest in doing that or if that would be considered.
Murmurs mm-hmm. of a lawsuit as well.
Oh,
so okay. Not sure what's going on there, but isn't that something? 2 million votes cast, and after a recount, only two votes shift?
Yeah.
Two votes. All right.
So a reminder, vote.
Yes.
Vote in November.
2 million people vote. If the Sue Kuehl Peterson had found 54 votes,
Right.
It would be two Republicans running against each other. Now you're going to have a Seattle urbanist.
Mm-hmm. A Dow Constantine clone.
With all sorts of enviro climate alarmist money behind her.
Him.
Behind him, David.
Yeah, up the Grove.
Going against Jamie Herrera Butler, who's got more of a statewide view of the issue. I think there's more state land under the stewardship of the lands commissioner in her old congressional district than any other congressional district.
Yeah. Yesterday on the show, after Labor Day, I went on a bit of a rant here on the sweep, talking about picket signs by a hotel workers union in Seattle. And it was a temporary, I guess, 1 or 2 day strike over the weekend. But it's hotel workers who are attempting to bargain a new contract. And one of the slogans on their picket signs on the strike line at one of the Seattle downtown hotels said, "One job should be enough." And I came across a picture of two King County Council members and one Seattle City Council member that were pictured, and one of the King County Council members holding this sign that said "One job should be enough" was King County Council member Claudia Balducci from Bellevue. And so I sent an email yesterday because I'm really curious about what this "one job should be enough" means. It's a beautiful slogan.
Yeah.
I don't think it has any relevant place in reality, politically or economically, and that's why I asked. So
well,
I emailed.
When we're talking about a workforce that many of them are young people.
Do you need an advanced degree to be a hotel worker? I'm happy to
be
corrected if I'm wrong, but my guess is you don't.
Office, unless you're
maybe
in the
a high school diploma, right? Something like that. Mm-hmm. So Claudia Balducci's holding the sign, says "one job should be enough." I would like to know what that means exactly. What's the criteria? What's the context for that? I emailed two of her staffers. They got back to me yesterday.
Oh, good.
I was a little surprised, but they did. And they said Claudia Balducci had posted about this on social media, on her personal account. And she posted on Monday, "Standing with hotel workers as they fight for a fair wage, one job really should be enough. As we work to make housing and transportation affordable," they're not doing a very good job. Yeah. "Employers," Balducci writes, "needs to do our part to pay a living wage to the people who power our economy through their labor." Well, you got to remember, the power of the economy is powered through people risking their capital. But she does not seem to acknowledge that part of the equation. But we'll set that aside for now.
Well, here's greater context.
Yeah.
At one point in her life, you know, Claudia was a single mom who was holding down a job while also serving on the Bellevue City Council.
Mm-hmm. Second job, right?
She had two jobs.
Yeah.
And even when she wasn't holding a political position, she was serving in a voluntary capacity on a city commission. Yeah. She's not living that sign.
Yeah.
She herself, as a single mom,
in a subsequent
was
post,
holding more than one job.
She wrote this: "I've been asked what one job should be enough means. It means a full-time job should pay enough to enable one to minimally pay the bills to live in our county," meaning King County. "People should not have to work two or three jobs just to keep a roof over their head and food on the table." And
there's a hand, guys. How many of us have had two jobs?
I noticed that she doesn't say anything about government jacking up the cost of living, which jacks up the cost of rent and so on and so forth. But what I think I'm trying to get the message here from Claudia Balducci is she's saying, you know, really, one pair of pants should be enough. And one prescription medication should just really be enough. And one class should really be enough. And one medical opinion should really be enough. And one roofing estimate should really be enough. So I think I'm starting to get her message. I see what she's saying now.
I will simply end this great segment by asking all of you who've talked to your kids about work, have you ever said to them, "One job's enough"? Have you? My guess is, especially when you're talking about young people, it's get out there and find what work you can. If you can get another job as well to augment your income, you do that. Anyway, the Commute with Carlson continues. Talk Radio 570 KVI. Speaking of work, we'll talk about the best and worst states to work in according to the people who decide where to locate jobs on the Commute with Carlson.
37 minutes after 7 o'clock in the morning on the John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI. Where is the best state to do business? Where is the worst state to do business? How does Washington's state rank? Well, the brand new Chief Executive Magazine, which conducts an annual best and worst states for business survey. They ask 600 American CEOs, representation from every state in the country. Tell us where you think a great place to do business is and a not so great place to do business. They find that the most enviable place, the best place in America to put down stakes and start a business, is Texas. The second best state is Florida. The third best state is Tennessee. Number four is Arizona. Number five is North Carolina. Six, Indiana. Seven, Georgia. Eight, Nevada. Nine, Utah. And 10, South Carolina. All right. So if those are the best states in the country, what are the worst states? Well, I won't read you the top 10. I'll just read you the top five, or the bottom five. The 46th worst state in the union for business, as adjudged by the Chief Executive Best and Worst States for Business, the state of Washington. Yes. The headquarters of Costco, of Starbucks, of Boeing, of Amazon. Well, the headquarters isn't in Seattle anymore, but Boeing, Amazon, Microsoft. Apparently, the state of Washington taking a lot for granted, sitting on its laurels. The CEOs around the country rank it the 46th worst state to do business in. The 47th is New Jersey. The 48th is Illinois. The 49th is New York, New York State. Second worst state in the country for business. The worst state in the country for business? California. California. You know, it reminds me of this interview that Kevin O'Leary gave last year to CNN. Kevin O'Leary is known as Mr. Wonderful on the Shark Tank TV show, which is the show where young entrepreneurs who have a new product that they have launched, but they are looking for investors so they can expand and grow their business. And so they are given a chance to step into the Shark Tank and make their case to these five, sometimes six, leading investors. Now, Mark Cuban, for instance, who very famous and very much a contrarian, the woman behind QVC, people who themselves have become incredibly wealthy, rich, and famous. Kevin O'Leary is Mr. Wonderful. He sat down with CNN, again, this was last year, and let them know what states are good and what states are not and why?
I don't put companies here in New York anymore, or in Massachusetts, or in New Jersey, or in California. Those states are uninvestable. The policy here is insane. The taxes are too high. We put them in Fargo, North Dakota, because 40% of the people work elsewhere, including Boston. So I was, you know, a bit of a debate with Elizabeth Warren about this, but I say, look, Senator, we've got to move the companies out of your state because you're not investable anymore. You're punishing people if they're successful. You overtax them. You hit them with a super tax. New Jersey, what a mess. New York, uninvestable.
Wait, California. Why is New York uninvestable?
Try and do a project in New York. Try and build a data.
Yeah, I'm asking, Don's point, is it beyond the taxes?
Oh, the regulatory environment is punitive. I had a project in upstate New York behind the grid in Niagara Falls for electricity, a global data center we were building. Eventually, it got so bad with the politicians in the local region and the state policy, we moved it to Norway and all the jobs. Norway has it now. Thousands of jobs coming out of that. I mean, that's New York, uninvestable. Sorry, don't shoot the messenger, just telling you the way it is.
Okay, and the CNN hosts kind of pushed back on Kevin O'Leary, and here was his response.
Uninvestable.
Some pushback from our elected officials in New York on that.
I was just going to say Kathy Hochul.
Yeah. But
I'll debate them any time of the day you want.
We would love to set that up.
Particularly AOC. She's great at killing jobs. She kills jobs by the thousands.
That may have been a reference to the role she played. You might remember when Amazon, who was not only taken for granted, they were basically being abused, kicked around by Seattle city government as if they should be thankful that Seattle let them grow their business here. Now, no other source of tax revenue, no other source was responsible for supplying more tax revenue to the city of Seattle than Amazon. And yet the city took, as Kevin O'Leary would put it, a punitive attitude toward the company. And so the company announced that they were looking for another city in America to have a second headquarters. And they were looking at New York. And, you know, think about this. The world's largest retailer, online retailer, wants to put tens of thousands of jobs in your city. And they, you know, fly in to take a look. And AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, former bartender who fancies herself a spokesman for socialism, starts banging the drum against having Amazon in New York. And then other people are part of the anti-Amazon squad, and then two left-wing Seattle City Council members flew to New York and urged them to say no to Amazon. I mean, think about that. They take the time and money, I hope it wasn't taxpayer money, but it probably was, and they fly to New York and say, you don't want Amazon here. We've got them back in Seattle. Big mistake. So you'll note that the states that Kevin O'Leary mentioned are the states mentioned on where not to do business, according to the CEO study of best and worst best and worst places to do business. And Washington State comes in 47th or 46th. The fifth worst state in America to do business. By the way, the top 10 states are all red states, Republican states. The bottom 10 states are all Democrat, including Tim Walz's state of Minnesota. They came in 41st. It's Boeing time on the John Carlson Show. 7:47, the commute with Carlson, talk radio 570 KVI. When we come back, Todd Myers gets national news attention. We'll play it for you coming right up here on The Commute with Carlson. Good morning. John Carlson Show. Yes, the caught our legendary lyric from ZZ Top. And Amy, KVI listener Amy in Kent, is going to the ZZ Top Lynyrd Skynyrd double bill at White River Amphitheater.
And wait till you hear this song live, John. That's all I can say on the 21st of September.
Oh, yeah. See, I think this is their signature song. A lot of other people would say it's, you know, LaGrange or it's Sharp Dressed Man. For me, this is ZZ Top.
Yeah.
It's the only single off their 1975 album, Fandango. It was a top 20 hit, but it's lived forever because, again, it's just the signature song for most people of the band. They wrote it in about 10 minutes.
Of course.
No kidding. Wow.
They were doing a sound check, and and Billy Gibbons started just hitting that opening lick, and they said, hey, keep it going, keep it going. And when I was young, I thought the song was called Touch. I'm just looking for some touch. Mm-hmm. Well, and now we know what he wanted to touch. The song is Tush, which had a double meaning. First is, of course, a woman's behind. The second is, hey, that's plush. That's deluxe, man. Mm-hmm. That's just tush.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that is how the band...
ZZ Top. How do you get a name like that?
I don't know.
I've heard that story.
Rhythm and blues. Ask anybody in rock and roll, if you get a chance to get on stage with B.B. King, he's tops. Huh? And then ZZ Hill was another one.
One of their early band names, ZZ Hill.
Yeah, so they went for ZZ King. Didn't fit. No. They just said, well, B.B. King's on top. ZZ Top. That's the name.
How about that?
A three-man band.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Beard, sunglasses, and hot rods.
That's all it took these guys. The bass player, Dusty Hill, passed away a couple of years ago, but he arranged for his replacement.
Yeah.
He died at the age of 72, which is longer than we thought most rock stars would live.
Yeah. Check with White River Amphitheater, ZZ Top, and again, we've got Lynyrd Skynyrd with the Outlaws, 21st of September. Love to see you there. It's going to be a great show.
Yeah, they are still charging ahead. Yeah. So, again, that's your legendary lyric. We have a lot more coming your way on The Commute with Carlson. Hour number three right around the corner. EVI, so nice having you here, ladies and gentlemen. Boy, we have a lot of things that we want to get to here on The Commute. Quick reminder for you. The Puyallup Fair, the Washington State Fair, the Puyallup Fairgrounds, ongoing right now. And you... men and women who have served your country in the U.S. military or who are serving your country in the military, whether it's one of the branches of military service or Guard, Reserve, whatever your service, you are being appreciated by the good people at the Washington State Fair. They are offering free gate admission to all active duty and veterans, active duty military and veterans, on Mondays. So that would be next Monday, the 9th, and the following Monday, the 16th. And Philip J. Vandervoort III will be there.
Yeah, midday, sometime 11:30 to 2, 3 in the afternoon.
So
after I get done with the show, I'll head down that way.
Yes. So I am going to be down there with Phil on the 16th. So not the Monday coming up, but the Monday after that.
There we go.
When we get into mid-September. So that's going to be a lot of fun. We look forward to that. All right. this shooting, first day of school, and we have a student wounded on his way to school, happened about 7 o'clock yesterday when a car rolled up to a school bus stop. This student from Graham, out near Puyallup. Here we have some of the details.
Investigators say a car pulled up and someone in the vehicle shot the 16-year-old as he was walking with a friend to a bus stop. No one has been arrested, and the evidence so far points to this being a targeted attack. The shooting happened shortly after 7 along 186th Street, Court East, between Puyallup and Graham.
Okay. Dark-colored sedan. A student was shot in the leg. He'll survive. Not a good way to get the school year going out there. But those are all the details we have so far. We have a lot more details about the overnight shootings on I-5. On Monday night, 5 people were hurt in a series of shootings on I-5 as they were driving, shootings the State Patrol says were random. A suspect was arrested in Faircrest after midnight on Tuesday. He was booked into King County Jail so far for investigation of assault. I don't know why this wouldn't be attempted murder. When he is charged, he will be identified by the rest of the news media. Again, 5 people were hurt. 2 of those people still in the hospital. 1 of them in serious condition, pretty bad shape. Captain Ron Mead from the State Patrol said it's really an attack on everybody, because any one of us could have been that unwitting victim simply trying to drive down the interstate. It's an attack on all of us as a society because it creates a fear in our transportation system that is unacceptable. Yes, this was terror. Absolutely. They used a vehicle description to connect the suspect to at least 4 of the 7 shootings that took place across King and Pierce counties. A white Volvo was the vehicle used by the gunman. First shots came Monday night from a white Volvo on northbound I-5 and Highway 18. That struck a passenger, a female, who was taken to Harborview in critical condition. She is there still, though her condition is now serious. Just 15 minutes later, somebody was shot while on Martin Luther King Way South, but was not able to give a description. The victim was a passenger, suffered abrasions from broken glass, did not require medical treatment. 1 minute later, northbound I-5, just south of Interstate 90, another victim reported being shot by an unknown vehicle. They suffered a very light graze wound to their leg. That person was admitted to Harborview more as a precaution than anything else, later released. And then nothing for several hours. Then just before 11 o'clock at night, a second wave of shootings. This one on southbound I-5, so it looks like he just turned around, he took a break, and then turned around and was driving back on I-5 near Highway 18. 2 victims reported being shot by someone in a white Volvo, Both the driver and passengers sustained injuries to their legs. They were taken to hospital. Luckily, they were both released. About 1 minute after that, reports came in of another person shot at by someone in a white Volvo. This out past Federal Way near South 375th Street. No one hurt, but the car windows were broken. And 3 minutes later, just after 11 p.m., near 54th Avenue East in Pierce County, another victim telling police a person in a white Volvo shot them in the neck. That person still in the hospital at St. Joe's in Tacoma. A seventh potential victim has now come forward after seeing the news, saying they were shot as well, likely right near the main exit to off I-5 to Federal Way, the 320th Street exit. Didn't realize what it was. And after seeing the news, they say, well, now it all makes sense. So when we learn more, particularly about the shooter and about the shooter's criminal background, assuming there is one, you bet we'll have that information for you. In fact, a very good chance Ari Hoffman will have that information for you.
I'm curious, John, here, and Phil, a question for you and for our listeners to think about, too. How many of us have something in our car, truck, for defense if somebody tried to attack us? I'm riding in cars of friends and family. I'm looking. I'm seeing baseball bats, crowbars, bear spray. And I'm just curious, are we at that point now where just if something happens, at least I want some defense to get away here? It's very sad to think.
Do I have defense when I'm the answer is sometimes. But yeah.
But more than usual, more than let's say 10, 15 years ago, you never worried about it. Like, yeah.
Well, not like this. I mean, yeah. I just told the story about the Bellevue sniper where one guy in the woods shot two people and wounded one, killed another back in 1973. And that was the big story in the news for days.
Right.
And again, it was just one guy shooting one time that I'm aware of shooting people when they were driving down 405. He was in the woods. And they caught him. His name is Carl Harp. He was like 25 years old. Sentenced him to, you know, life in prison. He had a parole date of 2023. He never made it. Committed suicide, allegedly, in prison back in the early 80s. But but it was so shocking and so ghastly that it just terrified people. And that's why it stayed in the news cycle for so long.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that, you know, now a lot of people are just saying anything can happen out there.
Yeah.
You know, yesterday Cuomo did a poll. What do you fear most when you drive? And, you know, drunk drivers, you know, congestion. You know, they gave several options. One of the options was road rage. It was by far and away.
Yeah. Probably like a 2-to-1 margin for whatever was in second place, I think.
Oh, well over that even. Well over that. Well over half the people said road rage. Mm-hmm. Because it's so unpredictable.
Well, it is. It's always going to happen. At least expect it. And, you know, everybody gets upset. They say, you know, State Patrol, all law enforcement, back off. Just let it go. I do this, and it helps relieve the stress. Try it next time somebody has road rage. If somebody passes me fast, cuts me off, I'm like, oh, my gosh, I almost got in an accident. I just say, God, help this driver. Just give them the scare of a lifetime where they will change for the rest of their life and enjoy life. And I'll let it go. And it's like, okay. Because you know it's going to catch up with some of these drivers and some of the things that have been done on our state highways and city streets.
Yes. Yeah. Well,
there's a problem of inability to cope by people who commit road rage. There's an entitlement sense of people that commit road rage that somehow they're due something that they maybe haven't necessarily earned. And then there's the escalation, de-escalation component that goes into all of it. So those are at least three of the things that go into when you have a road rage situation. Somebody just doesn't have a grip on reality.
What I suggest all you men do, all you men over 40, is what I do. And that is, you know, when someone rolls down their window and starts yelling at you, you just roll down your window at them and say, "You got a problem with me, pal? The name's Vandervoort. Phil Vandervoort. You got a problem."
V-A-N-D-E-R.
"You just tell me where and when, pal. Vandervoort. Phil Vandervoort." And I've never had a problem.
Problem solved. You
know? No one's ever bothered me. It is 16 minutes after 8 o'clock. The Commute with Carlson Talk Radio 570 KVI. Text line has been busy, 206-421-5757. That's 206-421-5757. We've been taking calls, a whole varied number of topics. Elaine from Marysville: "My Seattle coworkers, many of whom are on the liberal side, had not even heard about the 80-year-old lady's murder, Ruth Dalton, killed in Madison Park, the carjacking, a couple weeks ago. She said many low-information voters don't know that Bob Ferguson is the state's top law enforcement officer and bears responsibility for the public safety problems in this state." Rick in Olympia said, "Let's correct the entire issue. Revoke sanctuary state status for Washington State." You know, if that were on the ballot, I bet that thing would pass 2-1.
And it was going to be on the ballot in Berrien, but a King County judge said, "Nope, you're not allowed to vote on that."
And here's the thing. This is one of those issues where the polls will say, "Oh, too close to call." And then when the election results come in, it would be 2-1. Yeah, revoke it.
And it may have been a different vote outcome 3, 4, 5 years ago. But I think there are too many examples piling up now.
Too many problems.
Yeah, it has caused numerous unintended consequences.
Especially when you're a state on the I-5 corridor, you're asking for trouble. Trouble will find you. Fentanyl will find you. We're a major. We've become a major hub for fentanyl.
And the proof in that is how often government officials want to give away Narcan and Naloxone.
It is 18 minutes after 8 o'clock. Philip J. Vandervoort III right around the corner. His favorite segment of the day, social media from socialists. And later on, we now have a motive established for a mass shooter. It took a year for authorities to release the mass shooter's journal, but that finally happened yesterday. And the question that should be asked is, why were you holding this for so long before letting people see it? Anyway, that's going to be part of this hour as well as the Commute with Carlson continues. Talk Radio 570 KV.
Phoenix to Seattle. Heat alert in effect tomorrow and Friday. For us, it'll be upper 80s, near 90 tomorrow, Friday.
That's the kind of heat wave I can live with, no problem.
Triple digits going south. Portland's supposed to get up to 103.
Woo! That's the kind of heat I don't like.
Stay hydrated. Yeah.
Anyway, it is, give me the 80s anytime. I don't mind that at all. All right, here we go. Philip J. Vandervoort III, your favorite segment, social media from socialists. What do you got?
Yeah, let's dip into something from one of the stranger writers in Seattle. The social media sweep sponsored by Muckleshoot Casino Resort. This one comes by way of a writer at The Stranger in Seattle, basically the publication of the Democratic Socialists of America, give or take a few, Hannah Krieg. And Hannah writes, new Cherry Street Coffee House It's a place you can get coffee and some breakfast sandwich type stuff. Mostly does breakfast and lunch type stuff. I don't believe that they're always open for dinner. We used to have one right across the street from us at the old Como Plaza location we were in. We would occasionally head over there and grab something to eat or a little bit of coffee.
Yeah.
And it says new Cherry Street Coffee House owner complained to the Seattle City Council that paying minimum wage may force him to close stores.
Okay.
Outraged, the workers at Cherry Street Coffee House shut down one of his stores anyway. And then Krieg concludes that business may have power in City Hall, but workers still run the workplace. Yeah, they rule the workplace, and they might rule it right into closing down. My question would be, how many new Cherry Street Coffee locations have opened in Seattle since the minimum wage went up to $15? And then where have they gone after that law went into effect? I'm guessing there haven't been a bunch of rapid expansions of Cherry Street Coffee locations since then. And that kind of goes back to...
Well, wait a minute. When they say they shut down a location,
yeah,
doesn't that mean they shut those people out of jobs?
Ostensibly, yes. Right? Cut off nose, spite face. Right?
I'm guessing.
Yeah. And this kind of goes back to what I've been ranting about yesterday on the show in this hour and earlier on the show an hour ago of the striking hotel workers in downtown Seattle that are holding a job that says... or a sign, rather, that says one job should be enough. And, yeah, if you have, and this all goes back to Claudia Balducci, who's basically saying it's incumbent on employers, including government, to pay a decent wage. No, it's really just incumbent upon them to pay a wage that is commensurate with the skill of the job. The decent wage depends on decent job skills. If you don't have unique job skills, if you don't have job skills that are easily replicated by somebody else, you're going to get paid a common wage. You're not going to get paid a unique wage. And that's why I think this sign that unions like the hotel workers, Local 8 in Seattle, are holding up to say one job should be enough, you're doing your union members a disservice by saying that. You're basically falsely portraying what your work skills are worth. And that's what's so maddening about King County Council member Claudia Balducci holding up this sign and posting pictures of herself on social media saying one job should be enough. It depends. Yeah, if you've got bankable skills, you'll earn a living wage. If you don't, and we're talking about most of the jobs that are at a hotel or Cherry Street Coffee as an example, the skills that it takes to do those jobs are mostly skills that just about anybody has. You don't have to acquire any special skill or expertise.
Yeah, this is, again, just another example of people who have zero understanding of running a business, telling businesses how to run themselves.
Yeah.
And again, if you have that skill set, if you know how to run a business, that's one thing. But one of the things, you know, this information just out that most of the people in the upper echelons of Kamala Harris and the Biden-Harris administration have very little, if any, experience in business.
Yeah, private
sector
business.
I don't mean owning or running. I mean just working for one.
An employee of a privately run business. Yeah.
And it shows.
Yeah. And we talked about this a little bit last hour with this one job should be enough sign that the union members are holding up. Claudia Balducci, the King County Council members holding up.
That's really got you going.
It really does. That no one talks about why it's so expensive to live in Seattle. Here's another example. The Seattle Times posted their story on social media about Seattle Public Utilities and Seattle City Light. So this is specific to people who are customers of Seattle City Light. So Puget Sound Energy has the most energy, electricity, utility company customers around Puget Sound. But Seattle City Light has the city of Seattle customers. And the Seattle Times story says the plans drawn up by Seattle Public Utilities and Seattle City Light call for average annual rate increases of 4% to 6% through 2030. So imagine your electricity bill in the city of Seattle, if you're a Seattle City Light customer, going up an average of 4 to 6% each year.
A year it compounds.
Through 2030. Exactly. Exactly. And that's going to make cost of living even worse in Seattle. And that's probably going to outpace inflation. But no one's arguing about, well, maybe we need to cut back on some of these proposed utility rate increases for Seattle City Light. Because that's putting people behind the eight ball financially if those utility bills go up. It just makes it more expensive to live in Seattle. And no one's saying boo about this.
It's 8:30. When we come back on the John Carlson Show, we know a lot more about a mass shooter and the mass shooter's motives. And we can guess about why the media was so slow to tell us about those motives. Coming right up, the John Carlson Show. Boy, this is a wonderful example, revealing example of what happens when something that is a national news story suddenly goes away when it doesn't confirm a pre-existing narrative. The pre-existing narrative, whenever there's a mass shooting, is it was probably triggered by bigotry. It was probably triggered by hatred. And if it is, the media jump on the story. And if not, goes away. In this case, it was hatred. It was racism. But not the kind the media like to emphasize and talk about. So the media showed little interest in it. But now we know what the motive was for the March 27th, 2023 attack on the Covenant School, a highly acclaimed Christian school in Nashville, Tennessee. A female mass shooter. You would think that by itself would get the media's attention. Shot six people, including three children, killed them all. Turns out that the shooter, Audrey Hale, had once been a student at the school. And we began hearing the media refer to, you know, she was believed to be troubled. It had a bad history with the school, and then the media just dropped interest, even though she left a journal. But interestingly, the police, law enforcement, would not release the journal. Now, I don't know if that's because that's what the cops wanted, or I don't know if that's because what the political, what the mayor's office told the police chief to do. Think about Dow Constantine telling the King County Sheriff what to do. I'm not sure what the politics are, how they work in Nashville. All I know is, for some reason, even though the shooter was dead, the media could not get access to that journal. Well, now they have it. And now we know the motive. The motive was racism. Audrey Hale, who went by the name Aiden, she was transgender. She hated whites and she hated Christianity. And she apparently yearned for an interracial relationship with a girl named Sydney, who apparently was a person of color. Don't know whether she was brown, black, I'm not sure. She bashed her religion. She bashed her parents. She said, "Can't believe I'm ready to do this, but I'm ready. I hope my victims aren't. My only fear is if anything goes wrong. I'll do my best to prevent that. God, let my wrath take over my anxiety." Wow, think about that. She's appealing to God for giving her the anger and rage necessary to carry out an assault on Christian children. "I hope I have," this is again in her journal, "I hope I have a high death count, ready to die, ha ha, Aiden." So, it was a hate crime. It was bigotry. Just not the kind the media like to talk about. Anyway, the Tennessee Star, to its credit, has published all 90 pages of the shooter's journal, which shows the real story that the media should be talking about, but won't, because it's not the kind of hatred they like to emphasize in their coverage. And after all, we don't want to start creating negative stereotypes about trans kids, do we? Speaking of trans kids, Abigail Schreier, a best-selling author and a tremendously courageous woman, has a wonderful video on PragerU. I've interviewed her here on the show before. And she said, since more teenage girls are transgender than boys, and 20 years ago, that wasn't even close to being the case, we should be asking ourselves why. This is fascinating. Have a listen.
If you know any middle or high school girls today, or if you are one yourself, it would not be surprising if you know someone who identifies as transgender. The latest statistics indicate that 2% of American high school students now identify as transgender, and the overwhelming majority of them are teenage girls. Between 2016 and 2017 alone, the number of females seeking gender surgery in America quadrupled. But if you graduated high school over a decade ago, it was unlikely that you knew anyone who was transgender because, according to the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, the condition underlying it afflicted roughly 1 in 10,000 people, or 0.01% of the population. Almost none of these cases were teenage girls. In fact, before 2012, there was no scientific or medical literature discussing adolescent girls who wanted to transition to the opposite sex. That doesn't mean that we didn't know about transgender individuals. Gender dysphoria, the severe discomfort in one's biological sex, has been studied for nearly 100 years. It almost always involved boys who began feeling it between the ages of 2 and 4 and were strong and persistent in their assertions to everyone around them that they were really girls. When a phenomenon that affects one half of a population, boys, suddenly begins affecting the other half, girls, and when its age of onset shifts from preschool to adolescence, something significant is happening. In 2016, Brown University public health researcher Lisa Littman began studying the sudden spike in trans identification of teenage girls. She concluded that peer influence and social media influence had a lot to do with this trans teen phenomenon. After all, based on parent reports, none of these girls had exhibited symptoms of gender dysphoria at the age that it typically first presents, early childhood. YouTube, Reddit, Tumblr, TikTok, and Instagram all host popular social media influencers, today's version of Hollywood stars, who insist that if you feel uncomfortable in your body, you're probably trans. Many promise that if you start a course of testosterone, all of your problems will go away. There's every reason to believe that these girls are experiencing real psychological pain. Rates of anxiety, depression, and instances of self-harm are all at record levels for this generation. A quick fix becomes very tempting. So it doesn't take much, a YouTube video, a friend's suggestion, to get a troubled girl to buy into the fantasy that gender transition is the answer. Unfortunately for these girls who do not have typical gender dysphoria, gender transition rarely offers relief. And it's a catastrophic mistake for psychologists, educators, and the medical establishment to rush these teens towards a solution that will almost certainly harm rather than heal. Because here's what's not in dispute. Unnecessary medical gender transition causes irreversible damage, high risk of infertility, sexual dysfunction, and the creation of a permanent medical patient. Tragically, we've made it far too easy for kids to take this path, long before they're ready psychologically or emotionally to make such a life-altering decision. Testosterone is easily obtained by today's teens. In Oregon, a 15-year-old can walk into a gender clinic. Yes, there are now gender clinics all over the country, and walk out the same day with a prescription for testosterone without her parents' permission. 16-year-old girls have been able to undergo double mastectomies, the removal of both breasts, without even a therapist's note. Predictably, hasty gender transition, remember we're talking about teenagers here, is now leading to a lot of regret. New testimonials appear on YouTube almost every week from teens who acknowledge that they made a terrible mistake and warn others not to make the same one. So how do you protect your daughter from being drawn into this dangerous and growing trend? First, limit their exposure to social media as much as you can. Several academic studies have already linked the alarming rates of anxiety and depression to young girls' punishing experience on social media, a place that often makes them feel sad, unattractive, and alone. Second, oppose the teaching of gender ideology in your kids' school. In California, gender identity education begins in kindergarten and proceeds through high school. The theme is that kids' gender identity is totally independent of their physical sex and something that only they can know.
Again, this is Abigail Schreier, author of the book Irreversible Damage, showing just how hauntingly harmful this movement has become to teenage girls. Again, gender dysphoria usually shows itself in 2 to 4 year olds, and most of the time it's boys. Now, that trend, and this is all in the last 10 years, is it's gender dysphoria is showing up in adolescence, teenage years, and is driven largely by social media and peer pressure. I'll tell you something. The J.K. Rowling's, the author of the Harry Potter book series, who bravely stood up and pushed back on the trans movement, and she did it when the trans movement was bullying a woman who was utterly powerless. J.K. Rowling came to her aid, her defense. And the reaction is just, from the trans movement, is little more than shrieking and name-calling and hatred and venom. So when I see people who speak up against that kind of hatred, boy, I admire them. I admire them so much, and this movement needs severe pushback. So many girls, so many teens are being so badly harmed by it. It is coming up on 11 minutes to 9 o'clock, The Commute with Carlson, Talk Radio 570 KVI. I see one of our favorite guests on the John Carlson Show getting some national attention. We'll tell you all about it coming right up. And we're back, The John Carlson Show. You know, we're going to hold the Todd Myers for tomorrow so we have sufficient time to talk about it. Besides, I want to tell you about this poll. This is a poll in the state of Minnesota. That's where Tim Walz is from, the governor of Minnesota. Went before he was added to the ticket. The poll in Minnesota, KSTP poll, had Kamala Harris up over Donald Trump 50 to 40%. Then they added the governor of that state to the ticket. Now she's up only 5 points.
They put the governor of their state and the people respond by moving in Trump's direction. Have a great day. It's going to be beautiful. Let's talk again tomorrow.